Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Comedy Concepts with your host, Nancy Lombardo.
Hello, hello. It's a beautiful day outside. Well, today we have a special treat for you because I've been so excited about our next guest. Like a child waits for an ice cream truck coming down the street, because he is fantastic. He's a legend. A great humorist. I just don't even know how to describe her. I think the best way is to start off with a little bit about her, just to give you a little taste of our guest, Christine Lavin. So, the infamous Christine Lavin. Let's maybe have a little taste of that.
Here comes Caesar, the dog whisperer. Good dogs clap and wag their tails. Bad dogs know the jig is up. They might be headed for puppy dog jail. Bad dogs must accept the fact you're not the leader of the pack. We pay the rent, we buy the food. To think you're in charge is ridiculously rude. Here comes Caesar, the dog whisperer. Kitty cats, you better look away. You might be cute in your puss and boots, dreaming about Cheryl Wheeler's cat's birthday. But you don't get excited when we walk in the door. You think playing fetch is one big bore. One day there'll be a cat whisperer that you can ignore, but today is not that day. Here comes Caesar, the dog whisperer. Caesar, the dog whisperer. Caesar, the dog whisperer is on his way. So stay. 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 Bad dog.
I love that. Now, our next guest, I had the pleasure of listening to years and years ago when creativity was much appreciated, and you would go anywhere to any darkened room to hear the really creative musicians of our times. And one of them I got to hear through my friends Sean Colvin and Cliff Eberhardt. I happened to be there one night, and there was this woman standing on stage, and I was expecting just a normal kind of song, folk thing, and she came out and just entertained and blew me away, and that woman was Christine Lavin. Miss Lavin, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I have been looking forward to this all day. I have just been researching you, and I cannot believe how incredibly creative you are. Blown away by your talent.
Thank you.
It's just, I remember you from Speakeasy.
Oh, way back last century.
Yes, but I remember the shows there. You and Cliff and Sean.
Oh, yeah. You know, the Speakeasy was such a great kind of a crucible for all the folk musicians of the time that we all, you know, became friends. We collaborated and struggled together and commiserated when we had those kind of experiences. But it was such a terrific place to work and be associated with.
Oh, it was a great environment. And what I really enjoyed about it was back then I was with a group called the First Amendment.
Oh, yeah.
And the First Amendment Comedy Troupe. And after our shows, we would go to the Speakeasy, and we would hang out there. And it was a great collection of just, but your songs were so brilliantly funny, so brilliant.
Oh.
And now you have a book out, Cold Pizza
yeah.
Breakfast.
Yeah, it just came out on the 1st, so it's brand new.
It's a memoir, and I hear it's been going gangbusters wherever you are, whatever bookstore you're in. It is just the turnout has been standing room only.
Well, yeah, I'm at the very beginning of this process. Yeah, at Barnes & Noble this week, they actually locked the doors. And I didn't know till I got an email from Phil Klum. He's the mastering engineer who's mastered all of my albums. And he worked on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou and all the
albums. Oh, I love that.
He was locked out. He had to stand in the hallway and listen over the speakers. I couldn't believe it. It was a thrill. But it was more of a thrill for me to be there when Irving Drake sang.
I love Irving Drake. Now, Irving Drake, for those my listeners who don't know, wrote Good Morning Heartache, and it was a very good year.
And he also wrote, I Believe, you know,
I believe
for every drop of rain that falls. And it was a very good year. I have a story about it in the book, and it's what happened to him a couple years ago. He was in Los Angeles, and Tierney Sutton, this fantastic cabaret singer, very successful and respected, plays all over the world. She walked up to him in Los Angeles, and she said, "Are you the man who wrote It Was a Very Good Year?" And he said, quite proudly, "Yes, I am." And she said, "You bastard." And he stood there thinking, "What?" And she said, "Buddy, you go from when I was 17 to when I was 21, when I was 35, then you go, now the days are short." She goes, "I'm over 40. I'm not ready for my days to be shortened. You've got to write a new verse, Buster." So he did. He wrote a verse that starts when I was 52. And then when I wrote this book and we were having this big book event, I said, "Come on, Irvin, you got to write another one," because he's 91. So he wrote when I was 89, and at Barnes & Noble, he sang the song for the first time. It's on YouTube now, so if you Google Irvin Drake.
Oh, I can't wait. I wish I knew.
It was a very good year. And it was done by, this filmmaker just showed up at the event, a woman named Sandy, I'm not sure how you spell her, I know how you spell it, I don't know how you say it, Bachom, it's B-A-C-H-O-M. And she filmed him doing it with a single camera, weaving between him, the musicians, and the audience. It's a single, it's like one of those Alfred Hitchcock movies where they have one camera.
That's wonderful.
She did a terrific job. I'm so thrilled because it's the very first time it was ever sung in public, and now it's on YouTube.
And it's a moment in history.
Yeah.
On top of it. It's a little piece of history there that we have now. And you've had over 20 solo albums,
mm-hmm.
9 compilation CDs.
Yeah, I'm working on another one right now.
Oh my goodness, you're very prolific. Now, let's give people a little bit of history, because I love the book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I love the book. It just took me back, and here I thought I knew a little bit about music. I know nothing now because I read your book and I go, "I didn't know that." Oh,
well,
I didn't know that either.
Did you like the part about the speakeasy, about, remember the fish tanks on the stage?
Oh, it was outrageous.
Yeah, Joseph, the owner, this crazy old guy, and he had these beautiful fish tanks with very expensive exotic fish. And Andy Breckman, who's a singer-songwriter who went on to create the television show Monk, which I'm sure everybody knows about. Andy, at one point, stopped his set in the middle, took out $5, and he slapped it down on the stool, and he said, $5 says, one of these fish won't last 10 minutes outside the tank." So somebody in the audience said, $10. They got it up to $25 till Joseph came screaming down the stairs, because I think he thought Andy was really going to do that, take out one of the fish and let it flop around till it died. But it was
that was the thing about the speakeasy, and when you performed there, it was moments. Now, as I remembered, sometimes you were solo and sometimes you had backup. Do I remember that?
Yeah, that's right.
I kind of remember a bass. A standing bass?
Yeah, there was a bass and a percussionist, Marshall Rosenberg, who plays with Buskin and Bateau. They're back together again. And he toured for many years with the Bacon Brothers. And so he's recorded on a bunch of my records.
You blew me away, because I went in expecting to see, you know, Cliff Eberhardt and Sean Colvin, who are my friends, and see them do their normal songs. And I got there, and I guess you were on before them. And I started to listen. And what is she singing? What is she singing?
I don't have any formal training, so I make up songs about anything and make up my own format. So I probably break a lot of musical rules along the way, but I don't know any better.
And that's what I love about your music. I love Cold Pizza for Breakfast is also your CD, isn't it? Is that a CD?
Yeah, it's a song that I wrote many, many years ago, and people have asked for it a lot. And in fact, I updated it a couple years ago when I was contacted by the choir from Kalamazoo High School in Washington. They wanted to sing it at their graduation. And the bridge of this song originally was about Dr. Herman Tarnauer and Jean Harris. He was the Scarsdale Diet doctor, and she shot him. And this is like 3 years ago. A high school in Kalamazoo wants to sing this song at their graduation. And I said, you can't do that. I mean, Herman Tarnauer, Jean Harris, I bet you don't even know who they are. And they go, "We don't, but we like the song." So I said, "I'm going to rewrite it for you." So I made the bridge now about Oprah trying to eat healthier.
Oh, okay. And now, you grew up in Peekskill?
Uh-huh.
Yes, and it's very interesting. I want my audience to know how you learned the guitar was through
I watched lessons on public television when I was 12 years old. It was WNET in New York City, and you could get a book from the station for $1. And I paid my little brother 5 cents to hold the TV antenna out the window for half an hour so the picture wouldn't jump. And I followed along with the TV teacher, and that's basically how I started.
Now, are you a left-handed guitarist? Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm left-handed, but I play right-handed guitar because when I started watching lessons on TV, I didn't know you could turn the strings around because I had the teacher. I couldn't talk to her. I couldn't ask her questions. So over the years, I'm grateful that I play right-handed because you can always borrow a guitar wherever you are. And if you're left-handed, that's really not something that you can do very easily. But Dave Van Ronk was my teacher for a while, too. And he was also left-handed and played right-handed guitar. And he said, your left hand will always be slightly smarter than the average guitarist, but your right hand will always be slightly dumber. So it's a bit of a trade-off.
Oh, and now, is it true? Do you read music?
No, I can't.
You don't read music?
No, I took piano lessons for 2 years when I was very little, like 8 years old, and the teacher would have a long pencil, and she'd hover over your hands with the pencil, and if you hit a wrong note, she'd crack you in the knuckles. So even when I think about her, my knuckles start to swell up. And when I finally quit those lessons, I think I developed a complete aversion to reading sheet music because I could do it for 2 years. I was doing it, but now I can't do it anymore. I think it's because of the knuckle wraps.
The knuckle wraps. I'm surprised it's not a song. You've written about every other subject.
Well, you know, it's funny. That lady, and I don't tell people her name because, well, she's dead now, and I didn't want to insult her, her style of teaching. But the funny thing is when my family moved to Geneva, New York from Peekskill, a few years later, she also moved up there, and they did an article in the newspaper about me, and it said that I didn't know how to read music. I had no formal training. And she called my mother up and complained. And she said, you know, it says she has no formal training. I was her piano teacher. Why didn't you put that in? And my mother said, well, maybe if you hadn't hit her so many times on the knuckles, maybe she would have mentioned your name.
Well, I think you're in good company. I seem to remember, was it Bix Beiderbecke who didn't read music?
There's a lot of people.
The cornet player from the 20s?
Yeah, I think so. But also Luciano Pavarotti, he couldn't read music. He learned everything by ear. And Irvin Drake, the other night when we were doing the thing at Barnes & Noble, people were asking him questions about Frank Sinatra. And he mentioned that Sinatra had zero musical training. He said he would walk into the recording studios with the big orchestra, and he knew exactly what he wanted and exactly how he wanted it played, and they played it just like that, and he sang it, and then he'd walk out, and he'd be done. And
wow.
So there, you know, musical, I wish I had more musical training because I love jazz. I just love all those sophisticated chords and those voicings, and it's one of my goals at some point is to really learn how to read music so that I could start to play more interesting chords myself.
Oh, yes, because you have not accomplished enough in your life.
Well,
touring the world and playing music. One more thing.
Oh, but you know, when you're a musician and you do things with other people, I'm just so aware when I'm around someone who is such a better musician. Just the other night, I went to a cast party at Birdland, and a guitar player asked if he could borrow my guitar, and I said sure. And I watched him play, and I thought, my poor guitar must be so unhappy when it comes back to me, because I play these simple chords, and this guy was like zooming all around the neck. And it makes my guitar very happy when I do lend it out now and then.
Well, that's interesting because I think your lyrics are, I mean, I didn't notice you were playing simple chords when I've been listening.
Well, they're simple to me. I do play some fragments of chords, because I don't know what I'm doing, I can't even tell you what their names are. But I've always felt that, you know, I'm lyrically stronger than I am musically.
This one, with the one finger and the two to the right, that chord. That's so interesting. And now, also, but you had, did you walk Joe Namath's dog?
Well, I never did. My brothers did. Because Joe was, when we lived at Peekskill Military Academy, the Jets trained there from 63 to 67. And Joe Namath was a rookie during one of those years. I forget which it was. But my brothers would walk his dog and wash his car, and they'd also make the beds of all the players during the day and wait on table. So it was very interesting in the summer times. I used to love football. I don't love it so much. It's so violent. And they got to do something about those helmets that are, you know, they've got to put padding on them or something because of all the head injuries.
I will never get football.
But Joe Namath was walking toward his car one day, and my brothers and somebody dared me to ask him if he would teach me how to throw a football. And I'm in real life, I'm very, very shy. But we already had heard he was such a nice guy and especially nice to children. So I asked him, and he showed me how to throw a nice spiral. And it was the same day that my sister's pet albino guinea pig named Piglet bit him on the index finger of his throwing hand, which our family was so traumatized, thought it was a national catastrophe. Our little pet bit his finger, but he seems to have recovered okay.
And now, so, okay, let's give him a little bit of history, too. So now you're 12 years old, you're learning guitar from TV. You
mm-hmm.
start to pick it up, and let the audience know when your first performance was.
The very first one that I remember was a Girl Scout dance, and I remember I wore like a granny dress. They were the style, this orange-striped granny dress. And I remember I debuted a new song I wrote called The World is Coming to an End. I was 13 years old, and I already had a twisted view of life. And but I also played at a hoot nanny at the military school. They had one in the gymnasium. And I played different school functions. I was a duet for a while with a girl named Roxanne Bodis, and we wore matching outfits. And I think we were most inspired by Simon and Garfunkel. And
in a twisted way, I would maybe. Your songs are so funny, and we didn't have time. I was trying to find Fireflies somewhere. I was on the floor listening to that.
Oh, the Firefly.
Firefly. It is so intelligent and witty at the same time.
Well, that came from a newspaper article in the New York Times, and it was written by a guy named Carl Zimmer. And as soon as I read it, I knew this is a song. And so when I started to work on it, I tracked him down. I wanted him to look at the lyrics. And I also tracked down the professor. I think she's at Brown University, who was mentioned in the article. And I sent them both the lyrics to make sure that it was scientifically accurate, because it's really important to me if I do something like, that's historical or scientific in any way, that's got to be exactly right. And I hear from both of them. And Carl Zimmer also writes for Discover magazine. And so before the record came out, for 2 days, it was available as a free download to Discover magazine readers.
Oh, wow. And I was cracking up when you had the part about the males get eaten or something. And then there was a crunching sound.
Yeah, there's a kind of lightning bug, well, actually firefly, because they're not really bugs, called Photurus. And what they do is, the way it works in the lightning bug world is that the females sit in the grass and they flash, a certain pattern of flash, and the guys fly around, and for every female flashing, there's 10 guys flying around, flashing her back, and then she gets to choose. So she gets to flirt with 10 lightning bugs at a time, and then she picks which one she wants to cuddle up with. But there's a kind called Photurus, and they sit in the grass and they mimic the same flashing as those females. And the guys who are flying around get all excited and confused because they think it's a female giving him the come hither sign. And he flies down to her, and his head gets bitten off, and that's the end of him.
Oh, wow. But you do it in song, which makes it so interesting.
Yeah, I call it a crunchy midnight snack.
Oh, no. Yeah, the voice is at the end, and then I'm listening it at the very end, and you hear the fireflies talking. I don't know. It is just so.
Yeah, it's funny, because the guys who played the voices of the fireflies are these really hip musicians, a band called the WMDs. And it was really fun to take their voices and turn them into like a cross between Kermit the Frog and a munchkin from The Wizard of Oz.
In a lot of ways, I would say you were ahead of your time, because who would know that down the road, that clever movies would be the new wave? Clever movies like Ice Age and adding all those things. And you were doing voices about so textured and so layered. But,
oh.
But so much fun. You were kind of ahead of your time. I grew up with Tom Lear.
Oh, yeah,
and I absolutely worshipped him. I just thought his lyrics were brilliant and smart. And that I find a very similar pattern there, a little bit piano-guitar difference, but the cleverness, the intelligence, and the fun is all there.
Yeah, he's really sort of the gold standard, and he only recorded and performed for a few years. He's a math professor. I'm not
at
sure
Harvard
where he
or Yale?
Today.
Harvard? Harvard.
I know he was at Harvard for quite a while. I think it might be in California. But I recently read an article about him where he mentioned my name. I thought, get out of town. Tom Larry knows who I am. And he also talked about John Forster. And he's one that I think of as so smart and clever. And his last name is Forster, John Forster. He has an album called Entering Marion. And Entering Marion is one of the cleverest songs ever. It's in Massachusetts. This is really true. Many years ago, the governor's brother had a sign business, and they passed a law, his brother, the governor, passed a law saying that whenever you enter or leave a township in Massachusetts, there must be a sign stating that you're entering Beverly, you're leaving Lowell. And it was to give his brother the business. And so one day John Forster was driving through and saw Entering Marion and just wrote the funniest, funniest song.
I'm writing that down because after this I'm going to look him up. I want to look this. And I want to, my chat room has some questions here.
Oh.
Let's see. Okay. Oh, the name of the book? Oh, sure. It's Cold Pizza for Breakfast, a memoir by Christine Lavin. And you can get that at www.tellmepress. You can also find out more about Christine on her own website, which is christinelavin.com. How simple is that, christinelavin.com? But we want to, I'm going to give you a little leeway because I don't want to surprise you. I want to play another song. And while I'm playing another song of yours, because I want to give them a taste, I just love everything, I want you to think of a passage you might want to read.
Okay.
Okay, so let's play a little bit more.
In 1968, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were killed by bullets, a tragic, shameful thing. In the years that followed, in this land of the free, how many more Americans would die in a shooting spree? The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention tracks this data down, brings it to our attention. From 1968 to now, the number killed by guns stuns more than 1 million Americans, babies, toddlers, mothers, more than 1 million Americans, fathers, sisters, brothers, more than 1 million Americans, students, teachers, brides, more than 1 million Americans, murders, suicides, more than 1 million Americans, neighbors, daughters, sons, more than 1 million Americans, killed by guns, more than 1 million American families miss someone every day, more than 1 million American lives simply blown away, more than 1 million birthdays, 1 million graduations, more than 1 million weddings with 1 million expectations. How can anybody justify this annihilation? Why is it we never get a convincing explanation? More than 1 million Americans, grandparents, husbands, wives, more than 1 million American permanently interrupted lives, more than 1 million Americans, co-workers and friends, more than 1 million Americans met heartbreaking ends, more than 1 million Americans who needed our protection, more than 1 million Americans who can't vote the next election, more than 1 million Americans who no longer have a choice, for more than 1 million Americans we must raise up our voice.
Okay.
In 1968, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King by bullets, a tragic, shameful thing. In the years that followed, in this land of the free, more than a million Americans died in shooting sprees.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, it's a very grim statistic. And I wrote that song after reading a column by Bob Herbert in the New York Times. It was in response to the shootings at Virginia Tech. And the column contained the statistic that since 1968, more than 1 million Americans have been killed by guns on our soil, not in wars, but in suicides, murders, accidents. And that's, and the number is even way higher today because I wrote the song a few years ago.
Wow. It's so haunting. You know, what's amazing to me, Christine, is that you go from this sense of fun and then take us right back to the folk of the 60s and 70s when I like to say when music was poetry.
Yeah, I think folk music is always, there's always a reason for the song. You know, I think of a lot of pop music as, it's like chewing gum for the ears. It's just something that, you know, to bop around to. It doesn't really say anything, but folk music has always had a reason for being, and especially songs like that song. I wasn't even going to make a record or record that song, but I sent a work tape of it to Elizabeth Edwards, who is a big folk music fan.
Oh, yes, you have a story of her, too.
Yeah, and she wrote back to me. She sent me a beautiful note, and she said that she'd given the song to Vicki Kennedy, who also felt strongly about it and thought that I should, for sure, put it out into the world, not just send it to them. And Elizabeth Edwards, with all that, you know, she was dealing with at the time, you know, her cancer had returned, and now, of course, we know way more about her life than we ever wanted to know.
Or than she wanted people to know,
yeah.
I'm sure.
But I
and it
thought
was nice.
If she,
you had made her something, didn't you? Or you
excuse
sent
me?
Her, did you send her a gift when she was going through a hard time?
Yeah. Because I'm a knitter, and I have knitting circles before my concert.
I love that. Can I just tell them what you do? May I?
Sure.
She knits and brings it with her on the road.
Yeah.
Right? And you sell it at you're amazing.
No, I don't sell my knitting because I don't make enough stuff. I give a lot of it away.
Give it away? Oh, even nicer.
Well, the funny thing is the first time I ever had a knitting circle at my shows, I just put it on my website. One person showed up, and she was knitting a little red square. So I said to her, so what is that going to be? And she said, it's a red square. I said, well, when you finish it, do you attach it to other red squares? Is it a blanket? She said, no. When I finish this square, I rip it out, and then I knit it again. So I said, how many times have you done this? And she said, about 100. So I thought, crazy people are going to come and knit with me.
I think she thinks like it's great. I just want to quote before, and I don't know if you have the passage available, but it's on YouTube where you're talking about, I don't want to give it away because it was so funny. I saw it on YouTube, where someone came up to you and was complimenting you on your music.
Oh, want me to read that?
Yes, but first, before you read that, I want to give a quote here from,
okay.
Because my audience doesn't know this, how many celebrities are fans of Christine Lavin? When I told people I was having you on my show, I got, oh, wow, she's big. They were such big fans. And Jeff Daniels writes about you, whether she's singing songs or merrily spilling her life onto these pages, to be in her audience is to be grabbed by the lapels, expertly led around, and when it's all said and done, laughed out loud, genuinely moved, and thinking differently. And that is such a wonderful quote. So if you don't mind reading now from your book, because it's a very entertaining book, which you can get at www.tellmepress.com. So,
by the way, that Jeff Daniels is an amazing guy. He just finished on Broadway in God of Carnage.
That's
and
right.
He was in the original cast with James Gandolfini. They replaced it with a new cast, and then he came back into the cast playing the part that James Gandolfini played. It's just a four-character play, and he's played both parts, and brilliantly. I went to see it, and I said to him, the big problem must be resisting the impulse to move your lips when the other guy is talking. because he knew all the lines. Well, anyway, this is a true story.
I love this story.
Last year, I went with songwriter Irvin Drake and his wife Edith to hear Tony DeSere at the Oak Room at the Algonquin Hotel. It was a memorable night. Revered jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli was playing in Tony's band, showing that Tony had indeed arrived. Near the end of the show, Tony introduced some of the musicians in the crowd, including Irvin, who's written some of our best songs ever, like I Believe, and It Was a Very Good Year. I was surprised when Tony mentioned me, too. Being a folkie, I didn't think I was on his radar. But it's so much fun to be recognized when you're at someone else's show. The sound of applause never gets old. After the show, I was in front of the Algonquin saying goodnight to the Drakes when a woman grabbed my hand and she squealed, "Oh, my God, I couldn't believe it when Tony said you were in the audience. I'm your biggest fan. I've been to at least 10 of your concerts in Boston. You're the best." I tried my best to act humble and said, "Oh, thank you so much." But she kept going, Your songs are amazing. I have all your albums. I have that song about going through dead people's houses, the one Arrow where you sing, I wish I could fall in love, though it only leads to trouble, oh, I know it does. The Mexican hat dance potato song you wrote with James, your dog. The Sylvia Hotel, the one about your cat's birthday. I stood there smiling broadly, hoping against hope that she was actually going to mention one of my songs. But every one she mentioned was written by Cheryl Wheeler. Every single one. She was bubbly and ecstatic, and her friends were so happy that she was so happy. So you know what I did? I hugged her and I said, "Thank you. You have made my night." Then I sent an email to Cheryl from the cab on the way home, telling her, "I'm expanding my talents. I did a very convincing Cheryl Wheeler impression tonight on the sidewalk in front of the Algonquin Hotel."
I love that story. I think you when you were just hoping, oh, let it be, you know, the next one song I have written or something. It was just
I know. It was just compounded by the fact that she'd been to 10 of my concerts or 10 of Cheryl's concerts.
It all became one concert to her, I suppose.
Yeah. The funny thing is Cheryl Wheeler and I were almost the exact same age. We're just 3 months apart.
But do you
and
look
Cheryl
anything
Wheeler,
alike?
Excuse me?
Do you look anything alike? Or?
I don't think so. But no, we really don't. But well, my hair color, it's gray now, and it used to be sort of a light brown, and hers is. And we both have blue eyes. And what we have in common is that Cheryl writes hysterically funny songs. Oh, my God. But she also writes these heartbreaking ballads that just break your heart. And so, but to me, Cheryl's much funnier than I am, and I love her voice. And the first time...
How generous of you to say something like that.
Oh, no, really.
That's
I'm
so
just
generous.
So, no, it's not. I'm just, it's a fact. I'm not going to lie. The first time I saw Cheryl play was in 1980 down in Greenwich Village. And my first thought was I don't want to say consumed with jealousy, but it was envy because she has a quality in her voice that I will never have. And Cheryl is someone who is completely unself-conscious and doesn't care what anyone thinks of her. We did a co-bill together last year. I went on first, she went on second, and I like the stage to be as bright as possible, especially because a lot of older people don't come to the shows, and they really need to watch your mouth when you're singing if they have any kind of hearing loss.
Yes.
And Cheryl's just the opposite. She wouldn't have any lights on her face. She was lit from above, so she was in shadows the whole time. She didn't care that it didn't look good, people couldn't see her well. She just doesn't care what anyone thinks, and I just love the fact that she's like that. She's just such an original. And by the way, she's got a book that's coming out completely different from mine. She was approached last year by a group of calligraphers. There's an organization in New England, more than 70 calligraphers, and they're doing her lyrics in a book of calligraphy. It's called Cheryl Wheeler. No, it's called Nice Rendition, The Lyrics of Cheryl Wheeler in Calligraphy. And on the thank you page of my book, I mention her book because she showed me some of the artwork for it. It's just beautiful. It's going to be a gorgeous coffee table book, and they're going to do a big show in the New England area with all of this art hanging, I think sometime in July.
Oh, that's
but,
so nice
you
of
know,
you again.
You should look her up. And I just love the fact that I'm beyond the age of envy or jealousy now when I see someone who's as brilliantly talented as Cheryl and as original and really doesn't care what anyone thinks. I just admire her so much. And I told those calligraphers.
That is so nice of you. That is so generous. You don't find that these days.
But I told the calligraphers that they should be prepared for a lot of other songwriters coming to them wanting to have their lyrics done like that. And I said, you have to be very, very careful who you do this with because you don't want to calligraphy bad lyrics.
Oh, definitely. And in the book, back to the, that's very nice of you, and that was Miss Wheeler's that we'll be looking at next. But let's talk about Cold Pizza for Breakfast, a memoir, because there were so many interesting, as a comedian artist myself, that I just love that you did that you don't find anymore, because in this age of instant fame or bites of comedy where nobody really does their homework, you had a retreat. Was it on Martha's Vineyard, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
My notes. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was a really wacky, you know, impulsive idea that I had because I was signed to a publishing deal and got a pretty good-sized check with a comma in it. And I didn't know at the time when you get a big check, you have to look at it as half of what it really is and save the rest for taxes. So what I did was I took a chunk of that money and I rented a bed and breakfast for an entire month on Martha's Vineyard, invited a whole bunch of friends, and secret ingredient, and I'm telling you, if you ever want to do anything with musicians, this will win them over. The secret to the success of the retreat was that I hired a chef to come make dinner every night, because nothing draws a musician, or probably a comedian, faster than it's even faster than an open microphone, a free meal. And so every night we had dinner together, and then we did these shows at a little coffee house on Martha's Vineyard, and they taped it. The first record is called Big Times in a Small Town, and the second record is called Follow That Road. I did it for 2 years, and then it just got completely out of control. It turned into like Star Search, and I couldn't deal with people just showing up and wanting to get discovered, you know, that kind of thing. But I'm very, very proud of the records that that came out of those, even though by the second retreat I practically lost my mind.
Well, after a while, when everything's new and fresh, it's always so inspiring. But when it becomes self-serving, it loses that enjoyment that you get out of it.
Yeah.
You're like, wait a minute, this isn't about you. This is about all of us doing
something. Yeah, too many people just, they showed up. They didn't want to jam. They didn't want to hang out. They didn't want to hear anybody else's stuff. It was all about me, 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 me.
And that's the other thing about Christine Lavin. When you are very supportive of the other comedians, you have been on the forefront of starting little enclaves of music to inspire other people. And I can tell just by your generous nature, how you're plugging your friend there, and how much you really do love, I want to say love, Irving Drake.
Yeah.
How long has this collaboration been going on with Irving?
I think I met him in 2002 or 2003. I wrote a song called Another New York Afternoon, and I wrote it about a guy who owned a delicatessen who was obsessed with Frank Sinatra, and it was the week that Frank Sinatra died, I think it was 1997 or 98, this deli owner played Frank's music nonstop in his store, and at the same time, one day he was making a sandwich for me, and he asked me if I could hook him up with somebody. He wanted to get married, and he couldn't meet the right girl. So I said, I don't know if I can introduce you to somebody, but I can write a song about your predicament. So I wrote the song about this deli and this guy making a sandwich, and I mentioned, at the end of the song, I'm on the subway, and I said, the man beside me is wearing headphones. Is that music? Yes, Sinatra's voice. The woman sitting with him looks like she needs to talk, but right now she is not first choice. I leaned to listen in a little closer. It was a very good year, my favorite tune. As we travel underground, the music curls around. Another New York afternoon. Stewart sings along with Sinatra's song, Another New York Afternoon. So in that song, I mentioned it was a very good year, my favorite tune. I would have said my favorite song, but that didn't rhyme, so I said my favorite tune. So the fact that I was in an audience one time, it was a comedy show. It was Angela LaGreca. Do you know her?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, at Don't Tell Mama. And she mentioned that Irvin Drake was in the audience. So I was like, oh, my God, the author of my favorite song. And so I basically sort of stalked him until he met me. And then he realized I wasn't a nut, that I was just a very devoted songwriter who loved his work so much. And I'm just so thrilled to get to know him and Edith.
Oh, wow. And then did that become part of your collaboration? Or?
Yeah. Irvin and I wrote a song together called The Peter Principle at Work. And it was about the last presidential administration. And he has a song called I'm a Card-Carrying, Bleeding Heart Liberal. And I covered that song, and it's on one of my records. I did it actually live in Chicago. And he also worked on a song with me called Attractive Stupid People.
I love that song.
And
that was another one I was listening to. I was trying to get that one. I had a list of songs. I love that song, Attractive Stupid People. It's great, though. And the thing, Cold Breakfast for Pizza. Now, and I believe the lyrics that follow this, and a warm Coke to wash it down.
Yeah, warm Coke to wash it down.
That is such the epitome of the road life. Because as a musician, if people don't know this, or comedian, you get in at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And breakfast is like,
Hey, Nancy, now tell me the truth. Have you ever done this when you've gotten into a hotel late at night, room service is closed, and you're going to your room and you're hungry, and there's trays out left by other people who didn't finish all their food? Have you done that?
Well, maybe.
I just happened
to see they didn't finish something.
That's,
go to that's, waste, the perfectly
yeah,
good
that's
honey.
Right. We're just recycling.
Think of French
that's...
fries. Oh, we have someone who wants to call in. Sheila, oh, let me find, I got to find my call-in number for her to give to her. Yeah, let me tell Sheila. I'm going to email her. You know what? I want to play another one of your songs because I just love you. Okay.
Oh, thanks.
And you pick out another passage for me while I'm doing it.
I know just
those
the one.
Were real
okay.
Words. So this, can you believe 13-year-olds know how to do that? Oh. The only one that wasn't was the last one, Yukari. I found that, you know, the internet is so great. I was looking up words that begin with U. Actually, I Googled difficult words that begin with the letter U. And there's actually like 10,000 websites. I am at the opera. I don't like the opera, but he loves the opera and I love him. I follow the libretto. I follow the conductor when I follow the plot. My head begins to spin. I don't understand a word, even when it's English. Everyone around me says this is the I don't like the opera. Look, I'm at the opera. It's a good thing he can't read my mind. How long did you say this opera was? 16 hours. Oh, pinch me. I am eating sushi when I do not like sushi. He loves sushi and I love him. I'm poking with a chopstick at a living, breathing fish stick. Oh my God, I think it's trying to swim. Sometimes eating sushi is like chewing on your own cheek or sucking down a bucket full of tentacle slime. I do not like sushi. Look, I'm eating sushi. Good thing he can't read my high mind. Interesting texture. What was that I was eating? Ooh. Now, I just have to stop here. This is a song I wrote back in 1985, and I've sung it many, many times. And a couple months ago, a guy named Rene Ruiz from a vocal group called Toxic Audio saw me do this at Birdland in New York, and he said, you know, you ought to write a version of that song for a man to sing. Because men have done stupid things in the name of love, too. Is that right? Testify. Testify, gentlemen. So I finally finished it. I'm going to try it out on you. Tell me if I'm on the right track. This is called Good Thing She Can't Read My Mind, A Dude's Eye View. I am at a shopping mall. I do not like shopping malls. She loves shopping malls and I love her. Each time she stops to look at shoes, I'm reacquainted with the blues. I am sure there are men here who concur. I wanted to stay home today to watch the Green Bay Packers play a monumental pigskin contest of the manly kind. Instead, I'm at a shopping mall. I can't stand shopping malls. Good thing she can't read my mind. Sure, I'll hold your purse while you try that on. No, I don't think that dress makes you look. I am at a craft fair. I do not like craft fair. She loves craft fairs, and I love her. There's topiary origami, face painting, scrapbooking, and her favorite, dream catchers. What the hell's a dream catcher? What the hell is decoupage? Rug hooking, that's something I might get behind. I can't stand craft fairs. Look, I'm at a craft fair. Good thing she can't read my mind. Make my own soap? How did you know that was my dream? I am not complaining, I'm just making observations. Expanding your horizons is a sign of sophistication. Now I'm at a Tai Chi class every Sunday morning, though sometimes thoughts of boxing overcome me without warning. I am at a chick flick. I do not like chick flicks. She loves chick flicks, and I love her. Oh my God, it's a double bill. Now I'm really feeling ill. It's Beaches, followed by The Way We Were. I am in an awful mood. I'm eating awful food. All I wanted was to kick back and unwind. Instead, I'm at two chick flicks. I can't stand chick flicks. Good thing she can't read my mind. Tomorrow night is fried green tomatoes and terms of endearment. Oh! Pinch me. So if you see me at a chick flick, see me in a craft booth, see me at a shopping mall wallowing in despair, don't feel sorry for me. I must be in love. Why in the hell else would I be there? Before I met her, life was dull. I never took any chances. Now I leave at every opportunity. I'm fine. I don't like craft fairs, shopping malls, or chick flicks. Maybe I will in time. Maybe I will in time. Join your book club. I would love to.
That is hilarious.
I hope there's no guy in here tonight who's thinking, I am at a folk concert. I do not like folk concerts. Oh, gosh.
That's it? Hello? Yeah. That is so funny. I am not a folk concert.
Well, you know, I think of that new version of the song as it's a perfect example of why it's so great to have a weekly place to go as a songwriter to try out material, because it was a singer named Renee Ruiz from a vocal group called Toxic Audio who saw me do the original Good Thing He Can't Read My Mind at Cast Party, the open mic every Monday at Birdland in New York City. And he said, you know, you should write a version for a man. And that would never have happened if I hadn't been going to Cast Party for 5 years.
And that's why it's so important to get out there. What would you give advice to young artists?
Well,
what would you tell them?
Boy, you know, a lot of things are different because of the internet, and people can sit in their own bedrooms and play a song and then end up on the Oprah show singing it if, you know, all the dots connect. But I think that if you're really in this for the long haul, that you really should go out and see as many other people who are doing the kind of work that you do, and you'll be inspired, you'll learn something. Even if you learn, God, I'll never do that on stage. But Dave Van Ronk had a great sort of a mantra that he repeated all the time. He said, when music of quality sells, it's good for all of us. So never root against your competitor if what they're doing is good, because it will eventually mean more work for you too. So it's really fun, too, to meet other people. Well, Nancy, you're a comedian, and you know
Yes. That
when you get past that point of, you know, feeling jealous when you see other people, that it's like you're in this very kind of secret little sorority or fraternity of people who do this very odd thing.
Well, I think once you get past the jealousy, Christine, it's just, and I can tell you're a very creative person, but when I see somebody who I like, it makes me want to be better.
Yeah.
I go, Wow, that was great. I want to do something like that.
Yeah.
Only I want to kick it up a notch.
Yeah, it's I've made so, like, lifelong friends from meeting other people at these open mic events. And in the book, I said, you know, the open mic I go to for a cast party and the one I did at the speakeasy before, it turns into friendships, collaborations, and sometimes romances. But,
ooh,
of course, I don't write about that in the book because that's what songs are for.
That's lovely. And you can get this book at all your major bookstores, Cold Pizza for Breakfast, a memoir by Christine Lavin. And you can also get it through Tell Me Press, which is www.tellmepress.com. And all of your music, I'm sure we can find at christinelavin.com.
Hey, can I read you another passage?
Sure, please. I want more.
Okay, well, we've been talking a little bit now and then about Irvin Drake, the songwriter who wrote It Was a Very Good Year. And this is an honest-to-God true story about Irvin Drake. Irvin was 23 years old, a struggling songwriter in New York. He was dating a gorgeous Broadway showgirl who was 21 and a real knockout. Irvin was madly in love, and though he knew it was quite a risk, he proposed marriage to her. She not only turned him down, she broke up with him on the spot. She was having the time of her life in New York and was not about to be tied down, especially not to a penniless songwriter. Irvin was devastated. He poured his sorrow into his work, writing the lyrics to Good Morning Heartache. The next day, he showed them to his friend, Irene Higginbotham, a black musician, a pianist, who wrote music to accompany his words. Irvin Drake and Irene Higginbotham sat on the floor of the recording studio when Billie Holiday recorded the song for the first time. They were too scared to tell her that they were the authors. Billie Holiday was a big star, and they were nobodies, but they shouldn't have worried. She knew a great song when she heard one. And her recording of it not only was Irvin's first hit, it changed his life forever. He went on to write the musical, What Makes Sammy Run, and Her First Roman. He wrote the Frankie Lane hit, I Believe, that thousands of schoolchildren have sung over the years. He wrote Tico Tico, Al Di La, Widow's Weeds, and hundreds of others. He wrote music for the Jane Froman TV show, eventually met a lovely woman, married, moved to Great Neck, and had a family. One day in the mid-1970s, Irvin Drake was drinking his morning coffee, reading the obituaries of Newsday, and he saw that showgirl's name. Her husband had passed away, and she lived one town over. He had never seen her again after she refused his marriage proposal, but he had never forgotten her, especially because she inadvertently jump-started his career. He thought of calling her, but he didn't. He did smile wistfully, however, when he realized that she was living just one town away from him for all these years and they had never bumped into each other. A year later, that showgirl was drinking her morning coffee, reading the obituaries in Newsday, and saw Irvin's name listed in his wife's obituary. She didn't call him for a respectable length of time, but she did call him eventually. "May I speak to Mr. Drake?" she asked nervously into the phone. "Hello, Edith," Irvin exclaimed. What happened next, in his own words, "Later I asked her if she was free that night, and she was, and I drove us to Elaine's in New York City where we had dinner with my friends. Later I drove her home and stayed over. We discovered we had a lot in common. Neither of us was a stamp collector." Irvin and Edith married in 1982, and have been together ever since. All those years they were apart, Edith never knew that Irvin had written Good Morning Heartache for her. I practically cry when I read this, Nancy.
Oh, my gosh. It's funny how, I mean, that's a lovely story. I think I might even have an album that's autographed by Irving. Now that you said that, did he ever play at the Village Gate? I'm trying to remember because...
Well, you know, his first name is spelled Irvin, E-R-V-I-N.
I think I have that. What happened was I had a friend who used to work at the Village Gate, but somehow ran into him. They ended up drinking. Coming back to the house, my friend came and said, "Where's your record? I want to get it signed." And he woke me up, and I said, "Why are you waking me up?" And he goes, "Where's your record?" I give it to him, and I go back to bed. The next day, I see this autograph, and he said, "Well, Good Morning Heartache." I said, "Why didn't you wake me up?"
Well, you know, if you go to YouTube now and look for that video that was just taken on Monday night at Barnes & Noble.
Oh, I'm going to.
You'll see
and
the
we've
camera.
And we've got a big chat room thing going on here, too. My chat room, people are emailing me. They're listening to the show, but they can't figure out how to do chat.
How to do what?
How to do chat room.
Oh.
So, but they're asking me questions on email. Okay. Also, Alter Ego. Hello, Alter Ego Social Net. They're on the line right now listening, and Boston Publicist is too.
Hey.
And then a bunch of people who are guest listening, and but I asked them if they have questions, but they're just, they said, we want to listen.
Well,
and,
but if you go and look at that video, you'll see.
Oh, they sent
Edith.
It to me. All right, we're posting it up here. We're posting it in the chat room.
Oh, my God, that's so great, because you'll see the camera, and as it goes, Edith Drake is sitting in the front row with the red hair, and when Irvin... And you'll notice when he sings the verse, when I was 21, it was a very good year for city girls who lived up the stairs. And he points
to Edith. Wait, I'm
going to
try something here.
Okay.
I haven't tried before, so just hold on. Wait.
Yeah.
See if I can do this. Here we go. We're playing from that live performance.
Oh, my God. This is great.
It was a very good year. It was a very good year for small town girls and small summer nights. Behind from the left, on the village green, when I was 17.
We have it on now. You can hear it, right?
Oh, yeah, this is great.
It was a very good year. It was a very good year for city girls who lived up there with all that perfume hair that came undone when I was 21.
Wow, listen to that.
Isn't that amazing?
Piece of history, people, a piece of history.
Did you notice all those perfect rhymes? Still doing it, a song of a lifetime. Irvin Drake. Irvin Drake.
Awesome, through the miracle of Nancy Lombardo.
Wow, that I can't wait to tell Sandy, the Sandy Bacham or Balcom who filmed that. She'll be thrilled.
Oh, I'm quick on the switchboard. Mm. I figured it out. I said, I think I can do this. That
wow.
is great. So we got to add this to your wonderful interview. This is great. I know you have to be going. This is so great. But I want to talk again, let the audience know about cold pizza for breakfast, a memoir. And oh look, I corrected the two the two question marks. It's actually on there. I thought it was my mistake. With two question marks, memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Christine Lav, and this has been a wonderful show. And you can get this at www.tellmepress. You can go to any major bookstore because that's where you'll find this major star today. I want to thank you for sharing everything with us today, Christine.
Thank you, Nancy, very,
and
very much.
And cold pizza for breakfast, my favorite, with a warm Coke. And yes, I did take the extra ketchups and honeys from the trays outside the doors, too.
Yeah, but I was eating the french fries and eating the donuts.
Hey, it's, you know, it was green. It was green, and I want to thank you. That's www.tellmepress, or go to christinelavin.com to find out more. And as I said in my review, which you can read on my blog, this is perfect when accompanied by her music. So grab this book, grab a little Christine music, and play. And why don't we just go out on a repeat of one of your songs. Okay, Christine? And thank
you,
you so very much. Christine Lavin, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Here comes Caesar, the dog whisperer. Good dogs clap and wag their tails. Bad dogs know the jig is up. They might be headed for puppy dog jail. Bad dogs must accept the fact you're not the leader of the pack. We pay the rent, we buy the food. To think you're in charge is ridiculously rude. Here comes Caesar, the dog whisperer. Kitty cats, you better look away. You might be cute in your puss and boots, dreaming about Cheryl Wheeler's cat's birthday. But you don't get excited when we walk in the door. You think playing fetch is one big bore. One day there'll be a cat whisperer that you can ignore, but today is not that day. Here comes Caesar, the dog whisperer. Caesar, the dog whisperer. Caesar, the dog whisperer is on his way. So stay. 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 Bad dog.
Thank you. That was Christine Lavin, our special guest. And join us again. This show will be archived, so you can listen to it again and again and send it to your friends. And that was a great treat to have legend Irving Drake on as well. Thank you all for listening. The book is called Cold Pizza for Breakfast, a memoir by Christine Lavin. You can get it at www.tellmepress and bookstores everywhere. Thank you and good night.